It's the same old game of words.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
So serious.
I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Welcome to this week's extra film segment for March 26, 2015. And I'm JD Duran.
And I'm Matt Oakes.
For those that aren't familiar with our extra film segment, this is a show that we do every Friday where we get to talk about some of the latest indies, classics, art films out there that we normally just don't get to talk about on the main show. We have a little bit of a special show this week. It's going to be a little bit unique in the sense that we are reviewing a film, but it's more of a mainstream film. And the first thing we're going to talk about isn't so much a film as it is a bunch of films. As
it is a million films.
A million films, as Matt is going to help us recap his experience at South by Southwest that he was at last week, as you heard on the show with his voicemail. And also what's unique about this show is not only the format change-up, but we are going to have three guests on this show.
Three guests.
We got one for our discussion of South by Southwest. Matt, one of Matt's friends from South by, Nick Tiffany, is going to be joining us for a conversation about South by. And then in the second half of the show, like I said, we're going to be reviewing Insurgent, the latest in Divergent series, and I'm going to be joined by two female guests for that, including my lovely wife, which should be a lot of fun. So
more like you, Surgeon.
Yeah, that's not
I'm
a
so
bad
glad
name.
I didn't have to see this movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah, consider yourself lucky.
I think the publicist set things up so that I was away.
Yeah.
And I never have to see it now. Yeah. Actually, like I feel like I'm kind of robbing myself of a really easy layup for my bottom 10 of the year.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, Divergent made your top 10 worst films.
It was number two.
Number two.
Beat it out. Horns was even bigger a pile of trash.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I don't blame people for not liking that film. But I wasn't a huge fan of Divergent either. We'll talk about Insurgent here in a little bit. Before we get into any of that, Matt, how's your week going, man?
JD, I just got a puppy.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's exciting. Yeah. I love it when people get puppies. That's nice.
So if you hear something jangle around in the background, that's my puppy, and his name is Hodor. So any Game of Thrones fans are probably reveling in delight right now. he's like this little black with like a little cute little patch on his stomach. It's an Australian cattle dog lab mix.
Nice.
So
yeah,
really cute.
Can't wait for you to start sharing the pictures.
Yep, my girlfriend actually hasn't come home yet, so she doesn't know.
She doesn't know. Nice. Surprise, honey.
Surprise, I got a puppy.
How fun.
So that's probably going to be occupying the rest of my life.
Yeah, for sure. My dog is sitting by my feet right now, resting, thank God. My week has been...
As she should.
Yeah, exactly. My week has been pretty good, too. Before we get into it, one thing I want to plug real fast is... for those that listened to our main show this last weekend on episode 109, we had a really fantastic conversation about Mystic River, but we also announced that coming up here in the next month or so, we're going to be starting a new Pixar movie series on the main show, which is going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to do it.
Ooh, and this, I like Pixar.
Me too. And we have a new poll out on our website right now where we are asking for your Pixar Final Four. It doesn't have to be in any particular order, just our four favorite Pixar movies, and then we're going to take the results of that, kind of add everything up, and that's how Brennan and I are going to finalize that movie series. So make sure you go to our website, insessionfilm.com, vote on that poll. It'll be very, very helpful for us here.
Can I give you mine?
Sure, go for it.
Okay, Up,
okay.
Toy Story 3,
yep.
Wall-E, Ratatouille?
Yeah, sounds great. I think that's...
Yeah. It's good. Maybe I'm leaving something out. Let me know
in
the comments if I did.
Yeah, I might substitute The Incredibles in there somewhere. But
I like The Incredibles, but it's never been my favorite. And I like the earlier Toy Stories too, obviously.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think what's going to happen is if we do Toy Story at all, I think what we're going to do is just combine all three of them is most likely what we're going to do. So
Fair enough. So,
anyway, go vote for that. It should be a lot of fun. We got a lot to talk about though with South by and Insurgent. So let's get into it.
And here we go.
Money's the motivation, money's the conversation. You on vacation, we getting paid, so we on vacation. I did it for the fam. It's whatever we had to do, it's just who I am. Yeah, it's the life I chose. Gunshots in the dark, one eye closed. And we got it cooking like a one-eyed stove. You can catch me kissing my girl with both eyes closed. Yeah, perfecting my passion, thanks for asking. Couldn't slow down, so we had to crash it. You use plastic, we bout cash. I see some people ahead that we gon' pass, yeah.
I never fear death or dying. I only fear never trying. I am whatever I am. Only God can judge me now. One shot, everything rides on tonight. Even if I've got three strikes, I'ma go for it. This moment.
You're listening to the Insession Film Podcast Extra Film Segment. Before we get going into it real fast, I want to introduce our guest for this segment. And we have Nick from the University of Houston, and the Daily Cougar is joining us to discuss some South by Southwest. Nick, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, what's up, Nick? It's been too long.
This week of out-of-festival experience has not been fun.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're finally caught up on all your reviews and interviews.
Well, for the most part. Three interviews done, and I need to transcribe I'll transcribe part of the app.
God.
There's no way I'm devoting, like, days to that.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
Well, for this segment, as we mentioned, we're going to be talking about South by Southwest, which these two fellas, Nick and Matt, got to have some fun experiences at. Let's just get right into it, fellas, and I'll toss it to you first, Nick. Let's just start off with the ones you guys liked the most. Just name two real fast that you would say was probably your favorites that you saw at South by this year.
For me, it'd probably be Ex Machina and Love and Mercy.
Okay.
So I got to actually see Love and Mercy a little bit earlier before South by. I don't know how it happened, but they made it work. And you've got a string of great performances. You got Paul Dano kind of getting to play the weird character he always does, but with a little more emotion this time. And then you've got John Cusack, who I'm trying to remember the last time he did something really, like, really good.
I think it was Hot Tub Time Machine.
Hot Tub Time Machine.
And that's a stretch to call that really good.
Yeah. He's incredibly emotional in the film as well. Elizabeth Banks gets to play a more straightforward character. She's not big and out there like her Hunger Games character, but she really, really surprised me. She's phenomenal. And then you got Paul Giamatti, who can literally do anything.
Sure.
That's quite a stable.
It's a good look into Wilson's life and how he conducted all the songs that he wrote, because it didn't just stop at him writing them. I mean, he's in the studio with the different bands right along with that. It's just amazing what went on in his head and how he got it out there and turned it into what the Beach Boys did.
Interesting.
And then Ex Machina.
Yeah, don't spoil Ex Machina too much for us, Nick, because had the ability to see it yet, or some of us have had the ability and decided instead to go to a extra bloody New Zealand horror movie.
I mean, I feel like I saw the same movie as you did with Deathgasm, but
yeah, right.
to keep it brief, on Ex Machina. The performances from Domhnall Gleeson and Oscar Isaac are great. But Alicia Vikander, who I think I said that right, who's playing...
She's the girl.
Ava. She's the Tinder girl. Artificial intelligence. Yeah, the Tinder girl.
Okay.
She's just captivating. Because this movie forces you to think a lot about artificial intelligence.
Sure, yeah.
Human consciousness and whether an AI can actually feel like we do and respond like a human. I mean, she's amazing in the script and the script. So Alex Garland wrote and directed it, and he did 28 Days Later,
which I love,
and Sunshine,
yeah,
which are two very, very great sci-fi movies. And so this one's a little more grounded in reality, but
nice.
So Nick, the more important question is, would you swipe right?
Oh, I would definitely swipe right.
So real fast, without giving any spoilers away, you're talking about how this film deals with artificial intelligence, which is something I feel like movies have hit on quite a bit over the last 10, 15 years.
Definitely.
What would you say, and again, try without spoilers, how does this movie separate itself at all?
I think it plays more towards humans' insecurities.
Okay.
And maybe they're over-understanding or misunderstanding of what artificial intelligence really is and what it's actually capable of compared to what we all think of when they say, oh, we're going to have AIs to do this for us. This isn't like a, oh, this is going to replace us or this is going to serve a certain job.
Yeah.
It's more of like looking at it at a scientific standpoint and then asking you to put all the science away and view it from an emotional standpoint.
Interesting.
Very cool. Ever since, you know, people have been talking about this movie and it's been screening across Europe and in various film festivals, I've definitely had my eye on it. Yeah, I wanted to see it.
Yeah.
I ended up, foregoing it in order to see something that was not likely to emerge in our markets for the next, year or two, or maybe never. But luckily it's opening in just like two and a half weeks or so.
Couple weeks, yeah.
Yeah, soon, so we will all soon have the ability to screen Ex Machina.
And it's a screening that I'm more than willing to go see again.
Sweet.
Yeah, I've heard.
That's kind of how I'm feeling about Furious 7.
That's my next Tuesday, Furious 7, and I come home and I'm going to pop in Interstellar after picking that up.
Very
that's
nice.
Back-to-back.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
So I believe that Ex Machina, Nick, was the only 5 out of 5 review you handed out at South By. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I'm kind of in the same boat, and I'll just forego your transition here, JD, and just say only 5 out of 5 that I gave while I was at the festival was to a film called The Look of Silence, which both Nick and I saw. We actually saw it together, which is the companion piece to Joshua Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing, infamously lost the Academy Award to
crazy.
20 Feet from Stardom, which was a piece of man. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves.
Wouldn't go that far. It's a good doc, but it's not Killing.
It's Hollywood. It's so cliche. It's so generic.
It's a Hollywood pick, that's for sure.
I saw this movie at a screening, and then like the girls came up and the director came up and they all sung, and I just rolled my eyes. And that was before like the Academy Awarded nominee. I was like, ugh, this is like, it's so overblown. Anyway,
I remember seeing them perform at the Rose Bowl.
It was out of control, dude.
And my mom made a comment. She's like, "There's a reason you were kept 20 feet from Stardom."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wow, okay.
However, so the Act of Killing, which I'm sure you've seen, JD, and a lot of our audience is familiar with, dealt with a dramatic retelling of the 1960s, essentially genocide in Indonesia, where these death squad leaders were going through and just calling people communists and killing them. And whereas the Act of Killing went and had these death squad leaders like reenact what they were doing, what the Look of Silence does is it has a brother of one of the victims go and personally confront these people.
Tidak, saya menganggap itu tidak besar. Bagaimana mungkin tidak besar? 1 juta orang dibunuh atau lebih. Soal dia politik. Jadi kepiye mak perasaan imam tinggal cerok di antara pembunuh anak imam. Kalau kita kaji dulu begini 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 kita ingin dulu, wow, udah payah akan kejadian seperti dulu, pasti akan kejadian.
Gosh,
it is harrowing stuff.
I can imagine.
oh my God, I was so blown away. I was so touched isn't the right word, but just deeply affected by the emotional depth of this main character. Nick, I'd like you to jump in on this a little bit as well, but he has this ability to, it's like he's going out there and he's looking for forgiveness. He wants to pass along forgiveness, but he finds himself at this crossroads where the people that he wants to forgive are not even acknowledging their crimes or repenting for their crimes. So it reaches this crazy standstill of like these insane lunatics being like, oh no, I did nothing wrong. And he's like, just say like you tortured and murdered my brother so I can forgive you. And they won't.
Wow.
I was just blown away.
To echo his thoughts, yeah, not only are they just not accepting of the blame, but they try to pass it on to someone else.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or they say, I didn't know what was going on. I was just doing what I was told.
And that's what's fascinating about the act of killing is that not all of them, but a lot of them, they reenact them and it's like nothing to them. And
they
that's
do
what's
it
so
gleefully,
crazy.
Dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy. Like there's moments in this movie where they're talking about literally stabbing a man like upwards of 20 times, cutting him open in the middle and so his guts are hanging out and then cutting off his penis. And they're telling it through laughter.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's repulsing.
Oh my God. I just felt so much. I felt so strongly during the screening.
But one of the worst things too was one of the guys he was talking to who was in the legislature pretty much says, we can do this again. We can start this again.
Oh, it's terrifying.
If you keep asking these political questions and whatnot.
Yeah, we will. He essentially threatens, like, either you shut up about this, or you know what? Maybe we'll click the on switch again and give this merry-go-round another go.
Wow, that is crazy.
This film, you know, it's a movie, it's a documentary, but it's actually had a lot of impact in terms of like the political shifts Indonesian socio-political statures and whatnot. So it was really cool.
Like people are just now talking about this in Indonesia. They finally, after the act of killing came out, I remember they were allowed to talk about it. There was discussion about what happened.
And isn't that what Joshua Oppenheimer said about the act of killing, right? Like he wanted to make that to get the conversation started.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And God, he's done a hell of a job.
Yeah, no kidding. It's just
phenomenal.
Well, outside the look of Silence, Matt, what's a second film that you would say, yeah, this is one you got to see?
I think for me, I'll talk about Trainwreck a little, maybe briefly later with Nick, but that's like a more I really really liked it, but it's more mainstream.
Film. Yeah.
So I feel like I don't need to rep it as much as a film that I saw called Lamb, which was another of my favorites of the festival. Written and directed and starring this guy named Ross Partridge, who was really awesome. I met with him, and then we ran into each other a bunch of times at the festival, but I had a great interview with him. And the film is about this man who's pretty much at the end of his rope. Everything is kind of deteriorating around him in his life. His father has just died. His wife has just left him. And he's just kind of lost. He's got no hope. He doesn't really foresee much of a future for himself. And one day, while he's smoking a cigarette, looking over the expanse of Chicago and the concrete jungle that is like urbanization, this little girl comes up to him and says, hey, can I bum a cigarette? And he, rather than like shoo her off and be like, no, like I don't give cigarettes to little girls, he's like, okay, yeah, sure, like sit here and talk to me. And he says, he basically takes this little girl under his wing and says, like, why are you here? Like, what kind of friends do you have that they would let you go and bum a cigarette from like a 45-year-old man? And they end up developing this relationship that is very similar to like a Lolita thing, except it's never quite tipped all the way towards being that, but you're kept on the edge of your seat wondering like if that's the way it's going to turn out. So there's this there's this dramatic gravitas to it in the relationship between them, and yet there's like this mounting tension that's a product of just kind of our cultural normative values of seeing like a 45-year-old man with a 11-year-old girl. And so it just plays really, really well with these dichotomies of like on one side of the fence, it's like, oh, they seem to be gaining things from their relationship with one another. And yet on the other hand, it's like, oh, that's clearly really weird. Like, I don't want a little girl to be hanging out with an old man. Like, it's so sure. yucky. So I loved it. I thought it was very, very complex. Great character study. Excellently performed. So that was another favorite of the fest for me.
And does that have a release date as of right now?
It does. So they're doing some more film fests and still shopping it out to distributors. But I'm fairly sure that it's going to get some play because it was one of the like hits of the fest. It's one of the sure. the breakouts. So yeah, yeah. I'm sure that we'll see it somewhere down the line, and I'll be sure to keep updates going on my site and whatnot, because yeah. I like to rep these films that
yeah.
you know, not a lot of people see.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool. Well, let's flip it to the other side, and we'll toss it to you first, Nick. What are some films that you saw that you're like, that was just the worst, I wasted my time watching that?
I mean, there are definitely a couple that I could have done without. Like, if I hadn't seen them, it's not a big deal. But I know one that Matt and I saw. It wasn't glaringly bad, but Fresno. Fresno was just underwhelming because it had all the elements to work. And you've got Judy Greer, who's great, and she's playing very against type for what she's used to. And you've got Natasha Lyonne.
And both of them are great in the film.
They're really funny, and they're great in the film. And let me pull up. I'm trying to remember. The director,
Jamie Babbitt.
I'm trying to think. She's directed a lot of television.
She's done a lot
shows.
Of TV. Yeah, and I think her directorial debut was "But I'm Not a Cheerleader," which also yes. had Natasha Lyonne playing a lesbian. In fact, I guess like nice. Natasha Lyonne is her go-to lesbian because she also plays a lesbian in this and in "Orange Is the New Black." Coincidentally enough, there you go. But she's and not a lesbian in real life. Nick and I,
and so that. the writer of the film, Carrie Dornetto, she's written a ton of episodes of Portlandia, South Park, Arrested Development, The Kroll Show, Community, and you got this all-female group, and it should work. All the pieces are there, but the film's very unsure of itself and what it's trying to say about sex addiction, and then goes off and has this whole murder backup story with it. And then there's this little Jewish boy who raps profusely. That guy sucked.
See, Nick, I will say if Fresno was the worst movie you saw at the festival, you're a lucky man. Because
no, yeah.
I can identify nice. At least six others that I liked less than Fresno.
You didn't catch Manglehorn, though.
I didn't catch Manglehorn. That looked really too.
It's not terrible, but from David Gordon Green and what he's done with Prince Avalanche and Joe just the last 2 years, this is yeah. like his Austin trilogy. Both of those films I really enjoyed, especially Joe. And I was looking forward to this, and it's Al Pacino, very yeah, toned down. Yeah. And you've got Holly Hunter who's around, and she's probably the best in the film with this little 5-minute monologue she gets. But it's just a very odd and depressing film, and you've got Harmony Korine in there playing some role out of Spring Breakers that has no business being in this film.
Hey, weird. You mentioned anything Spring Breakers, I'm on board. I don't care where it's at.
I am so not on board.
Spring Breakers! I loved that movie. I don't care what world it is.
I will give it credit for propping up A24 and making it more in the spotlight, but aside from that, I did not like that movie. You know, I'm going to talk very, very briefly because I'd rather talk about things that I liked than didn't like. But I feel like I got a diss on Wild Horses because that was just such a POS.
Yeah, that's the Robert Duvall movie, right?
That's the Robert Duvall one. And I interviewed him and I was like, wow, like I was surprised. He's like a really nice guy for like a living film legend. I thought he would be like grumpy and cantankerous.
Sure.
But
like no, his character from The Judge.
like pretty much every character he played.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But he was actually a really nice guy, and I hadn't seen the film yet, and I was all kind of looking forward to it. I had a feeling that it wasn't going to be very good, but it was so bad. Oh, it was so bad. He had his wife act in it, and she's like her performance is so poor. Like, you almost feel like she had a mnemonic knowledge of the material. Like they went over like how to say things right before they did the take, and she'd be like, I gotta get my guy, and she's like, she's Argentinian, and she's doing like a Texas accent, and it's just, it's so sad. It's so wow. Pathetic. So, it's just horrible, and the movie is just dramatically flat. And
speaking of Spring Breakers and out of place scenarios, James Franco is in this. James Franco, that seems odd.
James Franco's in it. I feel like James Franco's in it only so he could have played a gay character. Because honestly, the material is just crap. Sure. Even Robert Duvall, when I talked to him, I was asking him about the original script because he rewrote a script from another director, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, the original script was terrible." And I was like, "Oh, it's not very good." And he's like, no, it wasn't not very good. It was terrible." And like, honestly, wow. It didn't get much better. So I won't waste too much more time on that. I do, however, want to mention a movie called Excess Flesh, which didn't get much attention out of the festival, but I wrote a fairly scathing review of it. And I got an email from the publicist of the film asking me to take my review down.
Of course.
And we got in a little kerfuffle online, a little back and forth of me going no and her going yes, because they had sent me a screener link and I'd watched it at home, and her argument was, oh, it plays differently at the theater. If you had been in the theater, it would have been a different experience, and everyone who saw it in the theater liked it, so obviously your opinion is wrong. And I was like, no, you're moving. And let it stand.
Nice.
To piggyback again on Spring Breakers, actually.
Oh my God, you guys are Spring Breakers.
Dude, it all comes back to it.
I got it on repeat, y'all.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but Benoit Deby, I don't know. He's the cinematographer.
Dubois.
He was the cinematographer for Spring Breakers. He was actually in attendance at Lost River, Ryan Gosling's directorial debut.
Oh, yeah.
And his work there, because Lost River is a very dark film. Gosling shot with all natural light except for these bright purple and pink neon colors.
Sure.
And some red in there as well. And the film looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, Gosling, said it's kind of like in the tone of a Refn film, yeah?
It's totally in the tone of a
no
Refn
surprise
film.
There.
Yeah. Gotta love that Refn film.
Well, what did you think of that one overall?
Overall, I liked it a good deal. There were still bits and pieces that I'm gonna have to reevaluate because it comes out on VOD April 10th.
Hmm. Oh, nice. So
there are bits of like excess violence in the film and blood that doesn't entirely make sense, and you definitely get another Refn vibe with all the hyper-violence and obsession with blood.
Gotta like the blood. The blood.
But one thing I do like that he got from Refn was just the use of imagery without having any filler dialogue, and just like he's got these nice pans up and down. And the location he shot at out in Detroit is perfect for the story he's telling, because
very
cool.
Detroit's kind of getting into the nightmare realm with everything.
It is,
yeah.
With everything that's being destroyed each day, it's ridiculous.
You need a film in a dystopian world? Detroit.
Go to Detroit.
Detroit is its own dystopia now.
It is. Oh,
but,
man.
But it was really, it's a very ambitious project for his first film.
And he wrote it too. He wrote that film.
And
right?
He wrote it too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to shift gears quickly. And I know there's so much to talk about. We could literally talk about South by probably for 8 hours. But Nick and I both had the chance, JD, to see two films, Manson Family Vacation and 6 Years, which were both picked up by Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
So those are fairly they're going to be probably, ironically enough, some of the most ubiquitous films out of the festival just because of the access that Netflix allows to this giant market. So if we could just touch briefly on both of those. Yeah, Nick, I know that you loved 6 Years. I really liked it myself, but give the listeners just like a quick 30-second synopsis or whatnot.
Sure. So 6 Years follows Teza Farmiga and Ben Rosenfield, who in the film are a couple and have been for 6 years. They're both going to school. I think it's clear that he's at least a year older and he's working
at an internship. Yeah, he's like a senior and she's a junior.
Yeah, he's working an internship with this record label and he's really hoping it'll lead to a job. And when it does, it's going to take him halfway across the country. And while that's the biggest thing in his life, Teza Farmiga is there thinking, what about me? What about our future?
The biggest thing in her life is pretty much him.
Yeah. Right? And so it really becomes this look at the degradation of their relationship. And it asks these questions of, is it selfish if I do something that's going to be good for me?
Sure.
Even though it might not be good for everybody else.
And
I feel
interesting.
Like,
yeah, that's interesting.
The film really soars on the two central performances. Both Farmiga and Rosenfield are excellent, and they're both actually playing their ages rather than have a 30 some odd year old playing a teenager or someone graduating from college. Both of them are right around.
I blame Judd Nelson.
Yeah, exactly. It's Judd Nelson's part. He was what, like 30 when he was doing
like
the Breakfast Club?
He's like 30 in the Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
Molly Ringwald's like the only one who's actually a teenager at that point.
But there's this great dynamic between the two of them, and they have excellent chemistry. The movie, in my opinion, I think it skirts a line of melodrama and kind of exaggerated reality, but I think Nick saw that a little less than I did. But it's very good. It's a great character study, and I think that anyone pop up on your Netflix should absolutely seek that out. And I think that Nick and I would both agree that that's also the case with Manson Family Vacation,
definitely,
which stars J2 Ploss and this guy Linus Phillips, who I wasn't familiar with before, but he's really awesome in the role. He's basically like a black sheep brother of J.D. Ploss's character, who returns home after being on the road for a while and basically being like a traveling artist vagabond type. And he returns back to spend some time with his brother with a newfound obsession with Charles Manson. And the film kind of documents like their trips through wherever J.D. Ploss's character lives as they kind of go to all these Manson hotspots, like the murder sites and whatnot. And it actually, for an independent film, it's predicated on a bit of like a twisty, turny nature to it, which you don't usually expect. And I think a lot of people will like this. Even it's not for a film about with Manson family in the name, I don't think that it's necessarily too dark for people. I don't think that.
No, not at all.
It's a family drama, right, Nick?
It's really, yeah. Cause I mean, a lot of people can look at it and say, oh yeah, it's all about Charles Manson. And going into it, I hadn't read the synopsis. All I knew was Manson Family Vacation and there was a picture of Charles Manson. So I assumed, okay, here's a movie about Charles Manson. But what it's really about is, it's these two brothers who, while not biological, still have a love for one another. And it really touches on the fact that family isn't just relegated to blood. Something I've always said with a buddy of mine who I consider like a brother. It's like, we're not blood, but that doesn't matter. And so it touches a lot on that, which was really great to see.
Yeah, I certainly tend to draw toward that as well, Nick, whether it's, you know, with my real life brother or that idea of just having friends so close that you do consider that. I mean, that theme and those kind of films tend to really draw near to my heart. So I'm really looking forward to this. The last I read on this, I don't know, maybe you guys can touch on it, but I don't know if Netflix has really released a date on when these are released, correct?
No, they haven't. They've just picked them up and they plan to distribute. However, there is speculation as to whether they'll just release it exclusively on their streaming platform, or if they're also going to try and coordinate with a theatrical release. And this was something that they were talking about with Beasts of No Nation as well, the Idris Elba Child Soldier film by the director of True Detective, which I think is going to be awesome as well. But a lot of theater managers have said, like, no way. Why would we do that? And why would we put it in theaters if people also had the option to see it at home? So I think especially like this year is going to be set a precedent for how multi-platform releases
look
in the future. So it'll be really interesting to see how it pans out. Because as of right now, no, there's no dates. And we don't even know if it's just Netflix or if it's going to come out in theaters as well.
And it's crazy how that is completely changing the game for sure. Let's switch gears real fast, though, before we get to final thoughts from Southwest. We got to talk about the mainstream ones. I'm very curious to hear your guys' thoughts about Furious 7. I've really enjoyed the last two films in this franchise. You can definitely consider me a lover of what they've been doing with this lately. So let's talk about some of the mainstream ones. I know, Matt, you talked about Trainwreck as well.
Nick being the inexperienced one, he didn't get to see Furious 7 because he didn't, like me, hide out in the bathroom after Spy.
Yeah, I messed up.
Nice, Matt.
This is a good story. Literally, I was like, okay, there's no way, because lines had started forming like 4 hours beforehand. And I was like, okay, there's no way I'm going to be able to get out of Spy and go and see Furious 7. So I was like, I'll just hide in the bathroom until Furious 7 starts. So I go in the bathroom and I'm hiding there.
How long did you hide there?
25 minutes.
Okay.
And then everyone's gone. And I'm like, okay, they've got to be letting people in now. And then, you know, people are coming in and out, and then a guy comes in and he goes, "Sir, I need you to leave." And I was like, oh, like, hold on, like, I'm almost done here. And he's like, "Sir, we're waiting to let people in until we clear the theater. You need to leave before we clear it." I was like, oh, God damn it. And just like stormed out of the bathroom, and my plan had failed. But then I just went with the, I just like went over and pretended that I was interviewing the cast and crew and stood with the VIPs, and then was like the third person to re-enter the theater.
Way to scam the system,
Nick,
Matt.
Yeah, Nick's got a long way to go until he
learns how to do that.
Yeah, you gotta play the game, man. But as for the actual movie, if the Furious and Fast franchise is something that has piqued your interest in the past, I guess piqued your interest is a funny way to be like, yeah, like, got me adrenaline hard, then this is exactly what you're looking for. It's like very much like it's more over the top than any of the previous ones.
That's crazy to me. That's crazy.
Oh my god,
it's over the top compared to like the longest runway ever. Yeah. Or it makes a tank
right?
I mean, I don't know if there's any particular moment that really tops like Vin Diesel's character catching Letty in the middle of like between two highways.
Crazy.
But there's the cars driving down through skyscrapers, jumping the gaps in Dubai skyscrapers. There are skydiving
cars.
There's so much explosions. There's Jason Statham. Literally every single action scene, Jason Statham will appear halfway through and just start up really hardcore.
Of course.
Double bleep for you there.
Yeah, I know. Great. All I could think about there wasn't what you said about Jason Statham. All I could think about is, God damn it, man. Now I got to edit that out.
That's really the only way that you can describe what Jason Statham does. But it's a lot of fun. It's so dumb. It's such a dumb movie, but like gloriously so.
I can't wait. That sounds awesome.
And Vin Diesel, who is hilarious and has just come out and said that Furious 7
will win the
Academy Award for Best Picture unless the Academy never wants to be relevant again.
That's great. I love it.
He's such a bad actor in this movie. I feel like this is like the worst performance he's ever done, which is amazing because he's always so bad.
That's saying a lot.
I know. He's made for two things, playing robots and playing trees. And anything that is not a robot or a tree is
That's very cool. True. Yeah.
He makes a great tree and a great robot.
Yeah, he does. All right, well, let's talk about Trainwreck, because I know you had a few thoughts on that one as well.
Nick, why don't you start us off on this one?
Sure. Trainwreck was probably the biggest film, the biggest big studio film I was looking forward to. Because I am a big Judd Apatow fan. I know a lot of people, his movies do always go way too long. They have in the past. This was only 2 hours.
Right, and it's still considered a work in progress. So that might even get down by another 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a great cast. If you've ever seen Amy Schumer on Inside Amy Schumer, she's hilarious as is. And you've got Bill Hader playing opposite of her.
Sure.
And there's not a lot that he can't do. And then you've got LeBron James and John Cena.
You see,
John Cena is hilarious.
Playing different versions of themselves. John Cena is all emotional.
Yeah.
He steals most of the scenes.
He's this man and very in touch with his feelings. but he's also close to 300 pounds of muscle.
Yeah.
There's a line in it where he goes, someone's like, he's in a tiff with someone in a movie theater, and the guy goes, "All right, why don't you calm down, Mark Wahlberg?" And he's like, "Mark Wahlberg? Yeah. I look like Mark Wahlberg if Mark Wahlberg ate Mark Wahlberg."
That's great. You see,
and LeBron James is playing this best friend who actually just acts like a best friend and not LeBron James, and he's concerned with his buddy's emotions and how Amy Schumer's treating him.
My biggest thing with that, see, I'm not a huge LeBron James fan in general when it comes to basketball anyway. And I've heard that he's really funny and endearing in this movie. And that's the last thing I need is now I have something
that's going to make me like
him. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be hard not to like him after this. He's really
great. Yeah.
He's so against type. Like, he's essentially playing like a female role. And nice. A lot of the comedy is kind of gleamed from just like the irony of like this massive black man being like all tender and soft and like, what are your intentions with my friend?
It's very fun. Oh, man.
I think the reason this film works the best, though, is Judd Apatow didn't write this script. It's the first time he's directed something he hasn't written, at least movie-wise, because Amy Schumer wrote the script.
Yeah.
And she is just as unapologetically funny as all the other leading men that you've seen in comedies. But she just owns it and she rolls with it. And it's very hard to look at her performance and her writing and say that she's not one of the funniest people in the industry.
I think one of the best things about her is just she's uncouth, and yet she doesn't do it just to be crass. Like, there's meaning behind it. And she's very her performance and her writing are very revealing of her as a person. You get the sense that although she is very caustic and very vulgar, that she is very much bearing her soul. And I think that that's really what sets it up to make it such a success in terms of like this dramedy subgenre that we have, you know, because it works on a dramatic level just as well as it does on a comedic level. And my God, it really hits on a comedic level. Every single, and Nick touched on this briefly, but every single supporting character in this is on fire. The cast is amazing. Yeah. There's not one person in this who, when they get their 15 minutes, they blow it. Like, every single character made me laugh. I mean, you get Colin Quinn in here, who it's been way too long since you've seen him in really any capacity. And just everyone is really funny. John Cena's hysterical. Dave Attell has a bit. Tilda Swinton is in this movie, and Nick and I didn't even know until after it was over.
She blends into everything.
She's a chameleon.
She is.
But that's, we're watching this movie, and we're like, who's this British fox? Yeah. Like, wow. Yeah. And then we read and we're like, wait, that was Tilda Swinton?
Yeah.
And then you look up pictures for Trainwreck, and she's everywhere. And it's like, what?
I bet you she cameos in like every film in Hollywood, and no one knows.
Probably.
I bet she's played a man like 8 times, and we just haven't been able to pick up on it.
Yeah.
She's a big middle finger to Glenn Close.
Does she not have an Academy Award?
I don't know. I don't know.
That is.
Yeah. All right, guys, let's get to
Final thoughts. So in 10 words or less, sum up your thoughts about South by Southwest.
Yeah, good try, JD. I think South by Southwest is best summed up by the surprise screening that they had planned. So, JD, I don't know how in touch with the festival you were, but there was all this speculation, like, what is the surprise screening going to be? They called it the super secret screening.
Yeah.
And
super secret.
Was, oh, it's going to be Fury Road, or it's going to be the Avengers, or less excitedly, it's going to be Entourage. But basically, there were all these thoughts, like, it's going to be this big new release that's coming out shortly.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It was a release of 1981's Roar. Which if you haven't looked this up yet, my God, do yourself a favor, watch the trailer. It is the most absurd film ever made. Over 70 of the cast and crew were injured by lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. It is Imagine describe that. What this film is. It's literally the director Rob Marshall had this idea, him and his wife Tippi Hedren, to make this film like a Disney film, like PG family film about a family who has a bunch of wild cats, and against the advice of literally everyone who has ever worked with a cat, they decided to use over 100 wild animals in like close quarters with the actors on this movie. And you see people gored, you see them mauled, you see a guy who gets his head nearly scalped off.
Wow.
It is insane. So South by Southwest is pretty much that movie. I had a great time. I love the Alamo Drafthouse theaters so much. They have good food. They have amazing chocolate milkshakes. And I just love South By. It's a great networking thing. I had a lot of fun. Went out for drinks. Went out to a couple parties. Wrote way too much. And I think I'm just about approaching 10 words. So
after all those 10 words. All right, Nick, what about you? Any final thoughts?
So this was my first time in Austin. My first time at South By. And I think probably my favorite thing and the biggest takeaway there was I'm so used to doing interviews with people who are very straightforward, well-dressed, and they're very proper, and they try to keep things very serious. But the mood here when the cast and crew of a film that just screened are up there drunk for their Q&A, the fact that these people are like, I'm just so used to not hearing people swear when talking about their movies. Yeah. But it's like the passion that these filmmakers and these actors and these writers all have there is incredible. And the coolest thing too is every time I saw someone with a film badge, I just assumed that they were press because that's what I went for and that's what Matt went for.
Yeah.
But to learn that there are just hundreds and thousands of people coming just because they love movies is really cool.
Yeah, sure.
And the atmosphere there is just unreal.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I've been trying to talk my wife into letting me go. But thus I have failed. But eventually I want to get there. It sounds like a ton of fun. It sounds awesome.
It's a blast.
Well, very cool. Before we get out of here, Nick, tell us where we can find you and your awesome stuff on the internet.
Sure. So you can find me at one of two places. I run my own movie website, nicktiffany.com. And then I also write for the University of Houston's newspaper. And you can go to thedailycougar.com/lifeandarts/movies. And that's where you'll find reviews and interviews there as well. And I'm on Twitter at NickTiffany10.
All right. Well,
.com.
.com. Well, thanks, Nick, for joining us, man. It was great talking to you this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Nick, we'll see you at Seattle International Film Festival, yeah?
See you then, yeah, that's right.
All righty. Well, just a few months away.
I know.
Hold on to your butts, as they say.
All right. Thank y'all again.
Thanks, man.
All right. Well, coming up next, we got two guests coming on the show to help me talk about Insurgent. Yep, we're going to do it. We're going to talk about it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Holes in the sky, pierced by the fire. Somebody tell me this is real. Thank you.
My name is Dustin.
And my name is Jessica.
And together we produce Popcorn Poops, the best married couple movie commentary track podcast on the internet.
Join us each week as we take turns picking films and then watch and discuss them together. If you're at home or with a computer or device, you can sync up the movie and watch it right along with us.
However, you don't have to sync up the film to enjoy the show. Feel free to tune in like you would to any other podcast.
Please visit us on the internet at www.popcornpoops.com.
Again, that's www.popcornpoops.com.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film segment. So my name is Tris, and I got my three boyfriends behind me.
OMG.
I can't let anyone else die because of me.
No one else is going to die because of you.
You know, I'm just one person. I'm not worth it.
No, you are worth it. You're more worth it to me. You have to promise me that you're not going to leave, right? I want you to promise me that you won't go.
All right, well, before we get into our review of Insurgent, I want to introduce two new awesome guests to the show. First, I want to introduce Britt from Eclectic Pop. Welcome to the show, Britt. First time on the show, actually.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and also joining us once again is my lovely wife, Brandy Durand, also known as the producer and funder of this adventure. Brandy, welcome back to the show as well.
Thanks for having me yet again.
Yep, glad to have you back. So anyone who hasn't listened to our Divergent review, Brandy joined me for that on our Extra Film Podcast last year. I went back and re-listened to it in preparation for this, and it was quite the conversation. It was pretty fun and interesting.
We got
fun little debate.
Some interesting tweets about it.
We did. We did.
Somehow we got on the topic of our wedding, and
yeah.
I said something.
You were essentially paralleling yourself as the head honcho of the Divergent world, saying that I own everything and everyone's out to get me.
Yes.
So, which I kind of disagreed with, but
yes. And someone, whoever tweeted us, was afraid there was going to be a mass genocide if someone ruined our wedding.
Yeah, exactly. I was pretty afraid of that as well. But anyway, that was a fun little review. I would certainly go and check that out if you haven't listened to it. Either way, Brandy, Britt, glad you guys are here. This should be a fun discussion. All right, well, let's get into it. Insurgent is directed by Robert Schwentke and stars Shailene Woodley, Ansel Elgort, Theo James, Miles Teller, and the list goes on and on. Britt, let's toss it to you first. And I guess since this is your first time on the show, first of all, give us a little bit of exposition here. Did you like Divergent? Have you read the books? And what did you think about the new film, Insurgent?
I know someone who has, and I thought this movie wasn't as strong as the first, as is often the case when it comes to sequels. Sure. But yeah, it was okay. It was a little, I had really high expectations because I'd went into the first movie with really low expectations and was really impressed. And then I had elevated expectations when I saw this. It kind of didn't deliver for me.
All right, well, what about you, Brandy? We all know that you loved the first Divergent.
Yes, I loved Divergent. It was my number one film for last year. So I, too, went into this movie with high expectations. The trailers looked great to me. I was super excited. And I agree with Britt. It totally fell short. Did not live up to any of my expectations. I borderline hated it. I don't know if I would quite go to say I hated it, but nice. I did not like it very strongly.
Well, this is going to be a fun discussion. So, I, unlike you guys, I did not like Divergent very much. I still had a lot of questions going into this movie, and I was kind of hoping, and I actually discussed this on that show with you, Brandy, when we were talking about Divergent, I was hoping that maybe Insurgent would answer some of the questions I had. It did not. If anything, it left me with a lot more questions, and it left me scratching my head even further, as I will make it 3-for-3 with Insurgent, as I did not like this film at all either. In fact, I think the best way to sum this up is with a tweet that came from our good old friend DJ Valentine from the Simplistic Reviews. And he said Insurgent, and really he was talking about the whole series, but Insurgent is like if Twilight ate Hunger Games and then pooped out Maze Runner, which I thought was perfect. So yeah, that's exactly how I feel about this movie. And I was also reading a review at the USA Today, and the reviewer here opened up the review with a quote from Shailene Woodley in the middle of Insurgent. At one point she says, "I don't know if this makes any sense." And that quote, I think, sums up the entire film and maybe this entire series so far, as this whole thing has just made no sense. I did not like it. This film was tedious. The characterization was so uninteresting to me. Even some of the special effects felt very cheap and weak in this. And there was, in some parts, it was stronger for sure. But everyone felt so lackluster here. I felt like everyone showed up on set and was like, "I'm here for a paycheck," and that's it. And that even includes Shailene Woodley, who I love. I feel like she did put some effort into it, but everyone else was so by the numbers, just skating by, really doing nothing. The direction felt so uninspired, and I think that's the best way to really sum this up, is uninspired. Nothing about this movie felt like it was trying to do anything worth a damn, and it just and you could tell it on screen. It was so flat overall.
Yeah, I agree. They gave me nothing to grab onto. Divergent, you know, to me, had a story. I was into it. You know, I could follow her character through this, you know, discovery of her being a Divergent and what all that means. And this one, Insurgent, it just went nowhere to me. I mean, we had this mysterious box and yada, yada, yada. But I just was so uninterested in all of it.
Oh, certainly. I totally felt the same way. I didn't, in the first movie, I was blown away by how I felt really connected and related to Shailene Woodley's character and everything going on around her. We were seeing it for the first time, and I thought this was really vivid sci-fi movies. I'm not really into dystopian films, so I had went in with that kind of chip on my shoulder, and it knocked it off, and that's why I was so impressed. But I have to agree, for me, a big problem here was the direction. You have Schwentke taking over from Neil Berger, who did the original film, and Schwentke has a hit and miss record. You
have
great movie Red, and you know, Flight Plan, and then he makes Time Traveler's Wife, and this late, his latest
R.I.P.D. is the worst. Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah, so he's coming off that. I thought maybe he's got a lot, you know, it lit a fire. He's going to blow everyone away with Insurgent, all of his haters, and it just didn't happen here.
No, I agree. I feel like artistically it's a little ambitious, because there's a lot of dreamlike sequences in this film, or there's times where Triss is in the simulator, and so we get dreamlike sequences there. And I felt like he was ambitiously trying to create something artistically there, but the rest of the film just didn't really lead up to it very well, and it felt so unearned for me. And even inside some of those dream sequences, it felt like at times it was just trying to get by. Like there really wasn't doing anything new or exciting. It was actually kind of bland. And because you're not invested in the character by that point, at least I wasn't, that I just didn't care. And that's the real problem. The screenwriting is just atrocious, for one. And maybe you guys can help me understand this. And Brandy, this goes back to our big discussion in the first one. I still can't get over the fact in this movie about why Divergence are a problem anyway. This series has not addressed this at all. The film has never explained why they're a threat other than just because. And I don't understand that. I understand the allegory. I understand what they're trying to go for with the metaphor. But in this kind of scenario, the allegory itself isn't enough to compel me to be interested. I mean, at no point have they made a statement saying, yes, Divergents are a threat to the system because X, Y, and Z, and we need to eradicate them. There's been none of that. It's been, you know what? You just don't fit in. And so now I got to eradicate you. It's like, come on. That is not enough for me to be interested. And this film, which I was hoping would answer that, Didn't. In fact, it just made it worse for me.
Just pretend you're in like high school or something and some kid maybe, is like, you just don't fit in. You just got to get over it and move past it, because I'm not going to try and explain again for round two why. But based off what you were saying, I will say, as far as the artistic elements, it got to a point with these dreamlike sequences and these Sims that I was over that too, because it reminded me of Focus, where they just kept, you know, you don't know lying and who's not. And I was like, I'm over trying to decipher, are we in a sim, are we not? Like, I was so over that concept by the end of the movie.
Yeah, I have to totally agree. And for me, the dream sequences, which I felt were a bit, he was trying to go for something Aronofsky a bit with that it seemed to be that I didn't know what was real anymore. Everything that seemed to take place in the film was, oh, wow, are we actually making progress? I mean, Naomi Watts' character talks to Shailene Woodley's character in the bed. I still can't tell you if that really happened or didn't. I don't really know the answer to that. And that's just what threw me off. Everything kind of left me on edge, and it just took away from the enjoyment of this thrilling adventures. Sure.
Well, and another problem I have, too, is that I felt no emotional weight to this movie. I feel like, at least in the first one, they did a decent job of at least putting stakes to the film a little bit. I mean, Triss's parents are killed in the film. I did feel a little bit of sense of danger. And in this one, I didn't feel that way at all, especially with the Theo James character and the Shailene Woodley character, and even Ansel Elgort, who is the brother of Triss. I didn't feel any danger really surrounding them. And whenever things did get a little dangerous, they had no balls to do anything and to go forward with any sort of emotional stakes or death or anything. In fact, there's a couple times they tease us with it with Miles Teller character. There's a couple of times that his character could have been killed. There was another supporting character that got into a scuffle with Trish. I'm saying this vaguely, not to give away spoilers, but at one point that supporting character supposedly quote unquote killed, and then he comes back. And it felt like they never had the gall to go forward and make those kinds of bold decisions. And so I felt no stakes in this movie. Like, everything came together in this like nice little neat package and tied everything together at the end on top of a twist that came straight out of The Maze Runner. And that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, even if that is the source material in the book, The Maze Runner came out last year. Everyone saw how that movie ended. Rewrite the ending to this book, make it different, make it interesting. And instead, all we got was exactly what DJ tweeted. It was Twilight that ate Hunger Games and then pooped out Maze Runner. That is exactly what this movie was for me.
I also don't know if I was supposed to feel emotional about her parents. You know, in the first one, yes, like, especially, sure, you know, when her mom died, you know, super emotional scene for me. I really enjoyed that in Divergent. But then in this one, they keep playing it, you know, that, you know, it was she killed them. And like, Kate Winslet's character mostly is the one who keeps bringing it up, that, oh, you killed your parents and you did all this bad stuff. And I'm like, am I supposed to feel bad for her? Am I supposed to resent her for doing all these things? I don't know what you want me to feel.
Yeah, I too was a little confused on the narrative on that. That the movie itself seemed to turn against its heroine in a way. It just didn't really present her in this. It put a spin on her. Instead of her being the protagonist of the film, she became, well, we don't know, is she good, is she evil? We of course would assume we're following a good person. But it's similar to my big problem with the Hunger Games movies, is that you have a heroine who just is got no emotion, and if she does, she spends the whole movie sobbing and there's nearly no call to action. She's angry and nothing really becomes of these emotions. It's very frustrated, and you know, it just gets trapped up in all these things. And then of course you're trying to add in a romance element to it, which absolutely doesn't work at all. But here in the first movie it worked, and I'm still perplexed on why Woodley and James had a lot of chemistry in the first movie, and then here in the second movie, zilch, nothing.
Yeah,
that's because her two other boyfriends are in the movie,
and that that was, I actually meant to bring that up in my opening statements. I completely forgot. But that first scene we see of Woodley and the trio of guys behind her, there is a shot where the first time we see them is Shailene Woodley's in front, and then behind her is Theo James, Ansel Elgort, and Miles Teller, and I literally had to cover my mouth to keep myself from laughing because they literally put all three of her romances from other films behind her. I felt like that was so intentional and
so distracting.
It was so distracting. like maybe you were trying to make a nod to that. I don't know, but if it was, it was so distracting. I literally, like, that first act, I don't know if you felt that way, Brett. I literally wanted to laugh out loud in the theater at the most inappropriate times to laugh. It was so ridiculous.
There were a lot of times where I felt a muffled laughter and certainly a secondhand embarrassment with some of the decisions that were being made. I don't know why they chose to do that. It's already awkward enough. But something that also struck me was that before when Divergent had come out, The Fault in Our Stars hadn't come out yet. And so people were making a big deal. They're getting ready to be in a movie where they're going to be romantic. And here they're playing brother and sister. And in that movie, Fault in Our Stars, I felt like Elgort and Woodley kind of shared this very strong friend chemistry. I wouldn't really say it was necessarily completely romantic. I would see that more with her and Teller and The Spectacular Now. But here, I thought, wow, they kind of really showed they have this really dazzling friendship chemistry. And here you see there is no camaraderie whatsoever in their dynamic. Yeah. They just cold fish together. I was not expecting that.
No, I do agree with you when it comes to the performances here and the chemistry between Triss and all the other characters. There really isn't a whole lot. And it's because everyone is just getting by. Like, no one is really trying. It's so easy to tell. And unlike you guys, I didn't really buy the romance or the chemistry between Theo James and Woodley in the first film either. I felt like a lot of that was so forced and so contrived and so unbelievable to me. Although I would agree that their chemistry is at least better in the first film than it is here, even though I didn't buy it. The one thing I want to get back to what you were saying, Brett, especially comparing it to The Hunger Games, I'll disagree. I think what The Hunger Games has done has been brilliant. I think the romance in those movies has been very secondary. They're not really the main attention to that at all. And I think what Jennifer Lawrence has brought to that character with her struggling and the writing of her emotions have been way, way more stellar than what I'm seeing here in this series. And with this one, and I think I want to touch on this a little bit when you guys were talking about with Triss kind of being this hero who's kind of on the fringe and she's really struggling and making these really gray kind of decisions. And I think the reason is because obviously she's struggling with the events of the first film. There's this forgiveness factor that she just can't get over. She's very angry. And I think that's a seed of a good idea. But I think the difference is the execution here has been so poor and it's been so unfocused. What I loved about Mockingjay Part 1 is that that entire movie was about Katniss and her struggle, and it was completely focused on it, and I loved it because of that. And in here, it's a part of the Triss character, but there's so many other things that's happening that I didn't really end up buying it in the end. Like you were saying, Brandy, with the dream sequences, that got old really fast. Then there's the Theo James aspect. Then there's her brother stuff. And it kind of keeps cutting its legs out from underneath itself. And therefore, when we get to that ending, it's not earned.
Yeah, I mostly agree with that. I definitely think The Hunger Games did a better job than Insurgent did. I mean, Hunger Games compared to Divergent, I don't really know. I'd have to think about that one. Because I love Divergent. But yes, I think Mockingjay Part 1, focusing on, Katniss's struggles and all that, did a far better job than Shailene Woodley here. Because we do see, her inner struggle, trying to forgive herself and all this stuff. But then, like you said, there is so much unnecessary stuff going on outside of that, that's where you just get flustered and I don't know what to think. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons I didn't like this movie, was because I was like, I don't even know what you want me to pay attention to. There's so much going on. I don't know how to follow this story.
Yeah, I agree. All right, guys. let's get to final thoughts and grades, and we'll toss it to you first, Brett. Any other final thoughts, and what grade would you give Insurgent?
I wouldn't have to say the final thoughts on this is that it wastes a really talented cast, and the direction scrambles. I felt the story definitely could have used some streamlining, and so I have definite emotional punch. And so my final grade would have to be a C.
Okay. What about you, Brandy?
I absolutely agree with the wasted cast, and who we have not talked about yet is Octavia Spencer, who was completely...
She was in the like two scenes.
Yeah.
She does nothing.
And so I wasted. Love her.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what was the point of her being in this? And I mean, she wasn't, not that she was bad, but I mean, her character wasn't that great. So yeah. I feel like she was also another one that was completely wasted. Grade. I think I'm going to have to give it a C minus.
A C minus? Oh, yeah. Man. I think you guys are a little bit more generous than what I'm going to
I think it's because we like Divergent so much that we're sad that this movie was so bad.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I think, plays a part of it. I didn't like Divergent. This one, I felt like, was way worse than that. This one makes the first movie look like a masterpiece. but I, as far as final thoughts go, you know, I do think that with this series, there are little seeds of ideas that I do think are interesting and compelling when you're talking about the oppression, boxing people into these certain categories, the effect that that can have on a person. I just feel like the execution is so wasted. And, you know, I've had arguments with people on Twitter and even on our website about those kinds of ideas as well, because I get the idea that the reason that Divergents are supposedly a threat, quote unquote, is just because they don't fit in. And I get that allegory. I just don't think that it's compelling enough in this world for it to work. And I feel like there has to be more to it, either that or focus on it a lot more. Give us something on top of the allegory. I feel like the metaphor is just... it's superficial and they do nothing with it. And it becomes this stereotypical, been done a billion times before YA movie that I just felt like was so mundane and tedious. And I was checking my phone the entire time, laughing at places that it didn't call for laughter. And that is not a good sign for your movie. So
it's very true.
The one thing I did appreciate is Miles Teller's sarcasm in this movie, I thought, was pretty good. And maybe it's because he understands how dumb and cliched the material is and just went with it. I
mean, maybe. You never know.
Yeah. But I felt like, though, he did offset what I felt was a pretty grim and boring story. And I felt like these characters were not only written terribly, but were just performed bad. I mean, I love Shailene Woodley, and I don't think she was really doing much here. In fact, maybe you guys will disagree, but I felt like the scene where she was having to be truthful because of the serum she's given was a little cringeworthy at times. And there was some expression she gave near the end of the movie too, where things are getting heated up, that I felt like it was the same. Like, there were some expressions on her face that I just felt like was not very good. And I love her. I love her, and it hurts my heart to say that, but that was my experience with this film. I just, nothing about this film really came together for me.
Yeah, that truth scene. She's done so much better.
Way better work.
Like, very similar, you know, situations, I feel like.
And I mean, one of the films that Britt brought up, The Fault in Our Stars, at the end of that movie, she gives some pretty heartbreaking, emotional, poignant speeches.
And a thousand times better
than this.
I agree.
So, yeah, this movie just was so flat from beginning to end. I would give this a D, easily a D. I'm close to giving it an F, but Miles Teller is going to get it to the D.
Oh, good, good. Thanks, Miles Teller.
Thanks, Miles Teller, for that. Anyway, if you want to read more of my thoughts, you can check out our Letterboxd page at letterboxd.com/InSessionFilm. And if you agree or disagree with our takes, I'm looking at you, Mr. Optimus Solo. You can tweet us at InSessionFilm or leave a comment on our Facebook page or email us InSessionFilm@gmail.com. Before we get out of here, Britt, thanks so much again for joining us. Tell us where we can find you and your awesome stuff on the internet.
Okay, and thanks for having me. You can find me at eclecticpop.com. I'm on Twitter at eclecticpop. Facebook is facebook.com/eclecticpopblog. And I'm also on Tumblr, which is eclectic-pop. And that's where you can find me. And thank you again for so much for having
me
on.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Brandy, where can we find you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter at Bran_Muffin89.
Yeah, and she funds this thing, so follow her and tell her that we're doing a good job, so that way we get to keep doing it.
Yes.
Thanks, ladies, for coming on. This was a lot of fun. Well, that should do it for this week's show. Once again, real quick, just a friendly reminder to not only follow us on Facebook and Twitter, but also subscribe to us on YouTube and on Google Plus. Just search In Session Film and you'll find us there.
And be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes to hear all of the main podcasts and these extra special film review segments. And while you're on iTunes, leave us a review, because that's how things get shared nowadays. Yep. We give you free content, you give us a review. Except most of the time, you don't. What do you know? We still bring the content. Maybe you do a review.
We've gotten some, though, to be fair to some listeners.
To you out there who know that you're doing good things. Good on you. But yeah, we'd appreciate that. And you can also sign up for the newsletter to get emails and updates and poll thingamajigs. You can do that on Facebook by clicking the tab, or at the website at insession.com/newsletter.
And that newsletter is going to come out later this weekend, so make sure you be on the lookout for that. The In Session Film Podcast is supported by our super awesome listeners like you. If you want to help support us, just go to InSessionFilm.com. You can click on our bonus content tab in our main menu to hear our bonus content for just a small donation of 99 cents. You can also just check out the In Session Film store, get a fun t-shirt, or just go to InSessionFilm.com/donate, and you'll see a bunch of information there on how you can help us, including a new monthly subscription platform via PayPal that you can go and check out. And also, one thing I would highly recommend is checking out our mobile apps for just the one-time fee of $1.99. And you can find that app on the Amazon market for Android devices, the Windows 8 phone store for Windows devices, and the Podcast Box app for iOS devices. All those details are on the site at insessionfilm.com/apps. As for the main show this weekend on episode 110, I'm pretty excited about this. I haven't heard terribly great things, but I'm very familiar with the organization it's based off of. But we're going to be reviewing a small film called To Write Love on Her Arms. The organization itself, I love, absolutely love it. The film, I'm really curious about. So, but because I love this organization, I'm very excited to watch this and discuss it. We're also going to be talking about our top three movies about addiction. So make sure you be on the lookout for that. Like I said,
that's fun.
should be fun. Yes.
Always a really stirring film.
Well, ultimately, that film should be about hope and recovery. So we'll see about that, though, because that's what that organization is about. Anyway, like I said, go vote on our poll and also check out our extra film next week. We're going to have an interview with a documentarian from a documentary called World 1-1. It's a really interesting doc. If you like video games, I would highly recommend checking it out. But we're going to have an interview with them, and Matt and I are going to review It Follows, which is getting a lot of buzz right now. I'm going to see that this weekend, so I'm pretty excited for that. Yeah, so that should be a lot of fun. Before we get out of here, Matt, any final thoughts before we leave, man?
Oh, you know, I have no thoughts in my brain right now. I'm thinking, like, where should I bring my puppy to walk him?
Yeah. Or how where should will, I plan to react when the girlfriend finds girls. Out? Yeah.
I'm just kidding, Morgan, if you're listening.
Does she listen? Because Brady doesn't listen to these at all.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, I don't think she's ever... No, actually, I think I made her listen once or twice. I was like, you got to hear this. This is this amazing podcast. And I put it on, and it's just me. And I'm like, hey.
Nice.
Hey, gotcha. So, nice. Yeah, no, I've encouraged her to listen, but
nice.
She, unlike me, is like actually busy with like work and stuff.
With real life stuff?
With like real life jobs. It's dumb. It's nice. Dumb. So,
very cool stuff. As far as final thoughts from me, I got a chance to watch a Charlie Chaplin film called Modern Times. This is a highly regarded film, big classic. I've never really seen any Charlie Chaplin film. I watched it, and no joke, I think this film is in my top 10 of all time.
Dude, Chaplin's amazing.
Loved it. Oh, my God. Yeah, I cannot wait to go and check out the rest of his work. Man, that was just incredible, incredible film. So
yeah, if you like that, you'll probably like most of his stuff, especially all of his stuff with where he's doing the I can't remember the name of the character. Not the champ, the kid.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah.
What am I thinking of? Anyways.
Yeah, you know, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, I can't wait to go and check it out. But anyway, go see To Write Love on Her Arms. It is available on Blu-ray and VOD right now, so you can go and check that out online and join us this weekend for episode 110. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next time on the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film segment. Welcome to this week's Extra Film segment for March 26, 2015, and I'm J.D. Duran.
And I am Matt Oakes. I almost just messed up my own name.
Matt something.
Welcome, people. I'm Matt Oakes.
Matt Oakes? okay, let's do that again.
No, keep going. That's gold.
That'll be a good outtake at the end. All right, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to this week's Extra Film segment for March 26, 2015, and I'm J.D. Duran.
I'm Matt Oakes.
God damn it, Matt. You gotta be the Ron Burgundy.
It's the Ron Burgundy. Yeah.
God damn it. All right.
No, leave it. Just go.
No, I've already screwed up.
All right. I'm doing it again.
Okay. I'll be prepared. I wasn't expecting it. So
be ready. Be ready. I'm Ron Burgundy. Okay.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. When that first shot happened of Shailene Woodley coming on the screen and those three guys behind her, I literally, like, Brandy and I looked at each other at the exact same time, and I literally had to cover my mouth from laughing out loud. Like, I was like biting into my jacket because I was like, I was about to lose it.
Yeah.
It was so funny to me.
Because we had talked about it before we went to the movie, like, well, this is going to be awkward with her three lovers. And then that pops up on the screen, and we just looked at each other and died.
Yeah.